their demos to work toward a recording contract, because that's what all the teen actors are doing nowadays. Susan represents Hilary Duff, who's had several albums go platinum. "And I heard she doesn't even sing all the songs, that her sister sings half of them," Mom chimed in excitedly. "No need to confirm or deny. My Nettie's going to sing all her own songs." Mom had me start posting covers on YouTube. Record labels saw those covers, and two, Big Machine Records and Capitol Records Nashville, wanted to sign me. Mom decided on Capitol Records because Scott Borchetta is going to be too busy with that Taylor chick. He won't have time for you. So I signed with Capitol Records and lived here in Nashville for 3 months last summer to work on songwriting. Then iCarly started back, so I worked on the show Mondays through Fridays. Flew out to Nashville on Friday night red eyes, had songwriting sessions, laid down demos, took meetings, and did photo shoots for album cover artwork and various press releases, then flew back to California Sunday night to be ready for the show rehearsals on Monday. Currently the show is between seasons, so Mom and I are living here for a few months while I prep for my first tour. I suspect this tour is going to be my first time away from Mom. And not because she's told me that outright, but because we share an email account and I saw an outgoing message from her to Marcus, where she told him the very thing I'd been dreading for my entire life. "How come you're crying, Mommy?" I ask her as tears spill out of her eyes. Mom arranges a bite of lasagna on her fork, then sets the lasagna'd fork back down in the frozen dinner tray, as if taking a bite of it would just be too much for her right now in her emotional state. "You just sound so beautiful," she says. But I know she's lying. Mom's "I think you did well" joy is not at all a tearful joy. It's more of an exhilarated, amped-up kind of joy. This here, whatever I'm witnessing right now, is something more, something deeper. I wish she'd tell me. I wish she'd just admit what I already know. "Mommy," I trail off, terrified for what I'm about to ask. Even though I already know what's happening, I want to believe it can't be true. I need to hear it from Mom. I need to confirm it. "So much power in your voice. The chorus is really just... wow." Mom blots her eyes with a Kleenex. "Mommy," I say again, slightly louder this time. I'm terrified of knowing, but I'm even more terrified of not knowing. "And then when you get back into the verse and you go to your lower register, I love your lower register," Mom says through tears. "It's got a kind of sultry thing. Mommy, do you have cancer again?" I feel the color drain from my face right after I ask it. I've shocked myself that these words have come out of my mouth. I feel frozen. Mom looks just as shocked as I do. Her tears stop. "What? No." She tries to laugh it off. "Why would you think that?" I take a deep breath because I know she's lying right to my face, and I know she's doing that to try and make me less scared, but it's making me more scared. Why is she lying to me about something so significant? "I saw your email to Marcus where you said your cancer came back." Mom looks down and the tears return, no different from the ones a half minute ago. My heart feels heavy as I watch her little body shake and heave with sadness. I get up from my seat at the desk and sit next to her on the edge of the bed. I hug her. She feels so small in my arms. "I don't want to miss your tour," she sobs, sounding like she really means it. I'm baffled. How can she care about that stupid tour right now? "I'm not going to go on the tour," I say, like it's as obvious of a decision as it feels to me. Mom breaks away from her hug and lifts her head as her sadness switches to anger. "Net, you have to go on this tour. Don't talk crazy like that, okay? You scare me when you talk like that. You have to go on this tour no matter what, all right? You're going to be a country music star." "Okay." Mom goes back to crying. I go back to hugging her. The Generation Love Tour is a mission to get my new single, Generation Love, on the radio. The reps at Capitol have arranged for me to perform for a bunch of radio stations across the country in what they consider an unconventional radio tour. Most artists go perform radio tours in the soundproof boxes that are radio stations in the hopes of impressing a few radio execs enough for the execs to add the artist's song to their lineup. But my label suggested that we leverage my fanbase from iCarly to show radio heads the value I carry. So instead of performing in soundproof boxes to two or three radio reps, I'll be performing in each radio station region's local mall to thousands of screaming tweens. Our first stop is in Hartford, Connecticut, or maybe it's Philly, Pennsylvania. It's hard to keep the schedule straight. Regardless, I get used to it quickly enough. I wake up at 8, groggy. We usually have a few hours left to drive on the bus, then Stewie, our bus driver, pulls into the motel that the label's rented for a half day, just enough time so that each of us on the bus can shower. I go first, and then Paul, the sweet guitarist with the thick twang, goes next. I have a crush on him. Josh, the other guitarist, who looks like a shorter, beefier Conan O'Brien, goes after that. Then goes Dave, the earring-wearing videographer documenting the tour. Next is whoever this week's regional representative from the record label is, then the press representative from the label. While the rest of the group is showering, I do press on the bus. We find a place to eat lunch, then have a sound check, then we have 2 or so hours to kill before the show. After the show, I sign autographs for 3 hours, get back on the bus, and then Stewie drives us to the next place. The experience itself is overwhelming, performing in malls for thousands of kids. I get so nervous that I practice the songs 20 to 30 times before our set begins, and sometimes blow out my voice before I even get on stage. Press and the autograph signings afterward are emotionally exhausting. There are a few interactions that feel worthwhile, that seem like this experience actually means something to the kids and their families, but the rest of the crowd just feels like sheep to me. Hey, Samantha Puckett, how'd you get out of juvie? Haha, good one. Where's your fried chicken? Haha, good one. Do you really beat up people in real life? Haha, good one. My dead soul smile spreads across my face and I look in their cameras while their mom apologizes 15 times for not knowing how to operate it. But other than the work itself, there are two things I'm noticing about this tour. The first thing I'm noticing is that a part of me is enjoying myself, the part of me that doesn't feel guilty for enjoying myself in the midst of such unfortunate circumstances. Mom's cancer and being away from her while she faces it with frequent rounds of chemotherapy and radiation treatments. This enjoying myself part of me feels fresh and new and exhilarating. I feel free. I'm even able to shower myself. I'm realizing for the first time how exhausting it is to constantly curate my natural tendencies, responses, thoughts, and actions into whatever version Mom would like most. Without her around, I don't have to. I miss her deeply, and my heart aches over what she's going through, and I certainly feel a lot of guilt about the ease I feel these days, but that ease is undeniable. Without her monitoring and weighing in on my every move, my life feels much easier. The second thing I'm noticing is that I'm eating. A lot. I'll eat cinnamon Pop-Tarts in the mornings, then I'll eat lunch and dinner with the band, both meals out, and I'll order from the adult menu, and rarely salads, and rarely substitutes, burgers and fries. Without being monitored by Mom, each bite I take feels rebellious. I hear her voice at every meal telling me, dressing on the side, no more bites, that's junky, you don't want a watermelon, but mind over matter. But her voice can't stop me from eating. I'm horrified by this reality, but simultaneously drawn to what's on my plate with an attraction that can only be described as lust. The fullness I feel after my meals is nice, and new to me, but it's immediately usurped by a deep sense of guilt. Guilt that this is not what Mom would want, that Mom would be disappointed in me. The guilt drives me to eat more. Boxes of Cheez-Its and store-bought cookies and pieces of candy or fruit roll-ups or whatever goodies are on the bus. Sometimes until my stomach aches and feels like it's about to burst. I go to bed unable to sleep on my stomach because I'm so overstuffed. I weigh myself in the hotel rooms that have scales in them, and the number keeps climbing, climbing, climbing. I'm horrified with every pound gained, but also feel unable to stop. I have been starving myself for years, and now my body is begging for me to stuff myself. This new relationship to food deeply confuses me. For years, I have been in control of my diet, my body, myself. I have kept myself rail thin and my body childlike, and I have found the perfect combination of power and solace in that. But now I feel out of control, reckless, hopeless. The old combination of power and solace is replaced by a new combination of shame and chaos. I do not understand what is happening to me. I am terrified of what will happen when Mom sees me. I did not expect the Hampton Inn & Suites to be the place where I have my first real kiss, and yet here we are. Room 223. I'm standing in front of the kitchenette, and my lips are touching Lucas's. He's holding my chin softly. I can't tell whether I like that or not, but I do like the kiss. It's more natural when you like the person than when you're doing it on camera. He pulls away. I really like you. Have a good night, he says, or I think he says. I don't really know what he's saying, and I don't entirely care. I'm too busy in my head thinking about the fact that I'm 18 years old and I finally just had my first kiss. Finally. I watch him walk down the hallway. I don't like the cut of his jeans or his long hair, but I like his queen shirt and the shape of his sneakers. I don't like how much he talks about music, but I like how much he likes me. I don't like how awkward he is, but I like how nice he is. I shut the door behind him. My vagina feels funny, but I figure I'll worry about that later. I shut the door and sit down on the couch. I don't know why in movies women always shut the door and then lean against it after the guy leaves. Couch sitting is much more natural. I'm sitting here going over it all in my mind. Lucas and I first met a few months back when I had a show here in Nashville. He was hired to be the band leader and play electric guitar for the show. The other band member said he was really good, the best in town. We spent a lot of time together that first week while we were all rehearsing. He was very nice to me, and at first I didn't think much of it, since he's 27 and I'm 18. But then I noticed him looking at me a lot, and I started to wonder if maybe he liked me. By the third rehearsal day, he started offering me rides home, which I took because I was starting to like him. I felt queasy around him in an uncomfortable but good way. On the last rehearsal day, he invited me to come into his house and listen to a Queen album with him. I was so excited. We listened to News of the World front to back while sitting on his wooden floor. He kept scooting closer to me and brushing his hair behind his ear, which was mildly repulsive to me coming from a man. That repulsion confused me because at the same time I deeply wanted him to kiss me. Or maybe it's not that I wanted him to kiss me. Maybe it's just that I wanted to be kissed in real life. Either way, he didn't. He drove me home to the Hampton Inn and dropped me off. And then the next day I left for the radio tour. I didn't see him much during tour because he wasn't on the road with us the entire time, but he was flown out for a few of the shows, the ones not in malls but rather on bigger festival stages when we did full band sets instead of acoustic ones. In between seeing him, we'd text every day and have phone calls whenever I got some privacy, which is hard to come by on a tour bus. He'd say things like, "I miss you so much," and "I really, really, really like you," both of which made me uncomfortable, but I didn't know why. On one hand, I liked that he was saying these things to me. On the other hand, I felt physically unable to say them back. Like I couldn't get the words out of my mouth. I'd get excited to talk to him, but then the excitement waned whenever we'd actually talk. He'd talk about music and reference all these different songs that I didn't know, which was fine if there were other things we talked about, too. But there really weren't. It was either music, or he'd be showering me with generic compliments like "the sun rises and sets in your eyes," or "you're my favorite person I've ever met." The few times that he joined us for festival dates were okay, but a bit awkward since the rest of the band was around, too. There was no space for private conversations, and yet I was all right with that. When Lucas tried to pull me aside to have one, I'd come up with excuses for why I couldn't. I was tired, needed to prepare for press, practice my songs, respond to emails from my managers or mom or Miranda. I've been so unsure about him for the past month. But now the tour's over and I'm back in Nashville for a week to record some new songs, and I'm staying at the Hampton Inn, room 223, and I'm sitting on the couch in 223, processing the fact that I just had my first kiss with him. And as much as I'm relieved to have my first kiss over with, I'm even more relieved to know that now I am sure about him. I'm sure I need to end this, whatever this is. I pull out my phone to text him, but just as I'm about to, there's an odd pulse in my vagina. It feels warm. I reach my hand into my pants and pull it out. My fingers are wet. This is gross. I need to shower. I'll text him after. I'm walking off the plane and tugging my shirt down so it lies flat. I'm sucking in and trying to look as thin as possible. Maybe Mom won't notice. Maybe if I tug my shirt again, she won't notice. Maybe if I hold my breath for 10 seconds, she won't notice, says my OCD voice, formerly known as my still small voice, but which I've since accepted as the pounding voice of mental illness. It's more sporadic than it used to be, and almost exclusively related to food in my body, but it's still here. I take a deep breath and step on the escalator, heading toward baggage claim. A young dad with a nervous laugh asks for a picture for his daughters. Sure, as soon as we get off the... He starts arranging the girls in front of me before I can finish my sentence. He snaps a picture just as he nearly trips off the escalator. He nervous laughs again. As I step off the escalator, I look out to the lineup of people waiting, and there I see her. The sight of her shocks me, and for a moment, I'm more focused on her appearance than I am on mine. She's lost a dozen or so pounds, which is hugely noticeable on someone with as small a frame as she has. Her face is gaunt and sickly. Her bones protrude from under her skin. She doesn't have any eyebrows or eyelashes. She's wearing the turquoise UGG hat I got her for Christmas to cover up her bald head. I'm shocked at the sight of her. I don't know what to say. Dad is standing next to her, but he might as well not be. I can't focus on anything but her. I can't believe she didn't warn me of this in any of our 5 daily calls. By the time we exchange hugs and I love yous, I've settled slightly. I've adjusted just enough to be able to take in Mom's reaction, which is the same reaction as mine toward her. A combination of shock and horror with a vacant smile on top. I feel sick to my stomach while I wait for her to tell me how ugly I am. How fat I've gotten, how I've made horrible mistakes, how I'm incapable of handling life on my own, of keeping myself in order. I brace myself while we pile into the car. A Kia Sorento replaced our old Ford Windstar. Nat, what happened? She doesn't face me when she asks it. She stays looking out the window at the bumper-to-bumper traffic on the 5. You're getting chunky. I know. I'm sorry. We've got to get you on a diet. This is getting out of hand. I know. I'm full of remorse, for sure. But there's also a piece of me that picks up a little bit of enthusiasm, a little bit of a lift in spirit, because this is the Mom I know. She's not weak, or frail, or soft, or beaten down by cancer like whoever the person was that I saw as soon as I got to baggage claim. Whoever that wilted excuse of a person was, I refuse to believe that person is my mother. The Mom I know is the person sitting in front of me, the person who is strong-willed and forceful and sometimes vicious. This is the Mom I know. Come on, take a sip. No thanks. Come on. I've never had alcohol before. And I'm only 18, couldn't I get in trouble? No one's looking, Jeanette, or you're fine. I don't know. The Victorious kids get drunk together all the time. The iCarly kids are so wholesome, we need to give you guys a little edge. The creator always compares us iCarly kids to the kids on his other hit show, Victorious. I think he thinks it'll make us try harder. I don't know if drinking is what gives a person edge. I look at the creator's drink. He picks it up and sloshes it around. It's some sort of whiskey mixed with coffee and cream. I do like coffee. One sip. Okay. The creator hands me his glass and I take a sip. I hate it. It's great. Don't lie to me. I don't like when you lie to me. I hate it. That's better, Jeanette. The creator laughs. I've done well. I've pleased him. Mission accomplished. It's the same mission I have every time I get dinner with him, which has gotten more and more frequent lately as my new contract for the spinoff he promised me is being worked out. The creator is doing the thing that I've heard from my co-stars he does with every new star of a show that he's making. He takes you under his wing. You're his favorite. For now. I like being his favorite for now. I feel like I'm doing something right. So are you excited to have your own show? The creator asks. Sure. Sure, that's it? No, of course I'm excited. I'm so excited. Good. Because I could give a new show to anyone, you know. But I didn't choose anyone. I chose you. Thank you. Don't thank me. I chose you because you're talented. I'm confused. He just said he could choose anyone, which made me feel not special, and now he's saying he chose me because I'm talented, which makes me feel special again. This kind of confusion is normal around him. I take a sip of water while I try and figure out what to say next. Luckily, I don't have to. How'd you like the steak? It was good. It was terrible, actually. Well, great and terrible. Great in terms of flavor, terrible in terms of how much I'm going to be fixating on it for the rest of the night. I ate too much of it, and too many roasted potatoes, and too many Brussels sprouts, and a roll, and glazed carrots. I couldn't stop myself. I ate everything. I feel so full, I'm disgusted with myself. Mom's got me on a Nutrisystem diet again, like we did back when we were in Nashville. We do it together, when we're together. But that's the thing. We're not together as often these days. She's consumed with her cancer stuff, and I'm consumed with my TV stuff. When Mom's not around to motivate and coach me, I can't seem to force myself to eat a cardboard cinnamon roll that tastes more like a protein bar wrapped around itself. I can't seem to order the dressingless salad. I can't keep up my diet without Mom. I'm a failure without her. Are you okay? The creator asks. Of course. Good, because you should be okay, he says gently. You're about to star in your own TV show for crying out loud. You know how many kids would kill for that opportunity? Every last one of them. I nod along. He reaches out and places his hand on my knee. I get goosebumps. You're cold, he says, concerned. I don't think that's why I got the goosebumps, but I agree. It's always best to agree with the creator. Here, take my jacket. He takes his coat off and drapes it around me. He pats my shoulders, and then the pat turns into a massage. Oof, you're so tense. Yeah. Anyway, what was I saying? He asks while he keeps massaging me. My shoulders do have a lot of knots in them, but I don't want the creator to be the one rubbing them out. I want to say something, to tell him to stop, but I'm so scared of offending him. Oh, right, he says, remembering his train of thought without my help. Every kid out there would kill for an opportunity like the one you've got. You're very lucky, Jeanette. I know, I say while he keeps rubbing me. And I do. I do know. I'm so lucky. Can't believe my baby girl is moving away, Mom says, in a way that's different from how Grandma would say it. Grandma would be weeping and saying it loud enough for the neighbors to hear. Mom says it quietly and can hardly make eye contact. Unlike her bill extension calls with Sprint PCS, this is not for show. I appreciate the ways in which Mom is different from her mother. It's just for work days. I'll come home on the weekends if I don't have to go to Nashville. Mom sighs. That's a big if. I'm hardly going to see my baby. Who's going to keep your eating on track? How are you going to shampoo your hair? Well, I did it on tour. Yeah, but I saw pictures. It looks greasy. She sniffles. It's just the best option since I don't drive and you can't anymore. Even though it's just a fact, Mom looks down. I can tell I've hurt her feelings. I might be able to drive again someday, she says timidly, like a child would to seek reassurance from an adult. I know you might, I say with loaded positivity, the way an adult would to reassure a child. We both look at her wheelchair, the wheelchair she's recently been given to utilize when she needs, an allotment that has gotten more and more frequent by the day. In the moment her doctor told her he thought she could use one, we both pretended it would be fun. She said I could push her around at Disneyland, and I said yay. Then I went into the hospital bathroom and sobbed, but there was no toilet paper left in the stall, so I used a toilet seat cover to dry my eyes. And then I went back out and said yay again. This goddamned wheelchair is the furthest thing from a fucking yay. It's a death sentence. Neither of us can admit it, but that's what it is. Once you're a cancer patient with a wheelchair, you're never going to be one without it. You're going to die a wheelchairing cancer patient. Fuck this.
All right, sorry about that,
Grandpa says as he comes out of the house to meet us in the driveway.
I'm ready to go now. Clean pants.
He gestures to the pants he just changed after spilling his entire tumbler of coffee on the first pair. I take a seat in the back, surrounded by the moving boxes I already piled into the Kia. I watch as Grandpa lifts Mom into the shotgun seat, folds her wheelchair up, and piles it into the trunk. And with that, we're off to my apartment. My first ever solo apartment. We pull up to the Burbank complex a little over an hour later. The complex is okay. It wouldn't have been my first choice, but it makes sense logistically. My new managers, I switched during season 3 of iCarly, arranged for Nickelodeon to pay for my lodging here and for a production assistant to take me to and from work. I don't drive since Mom says it's probably too difficult for me and that my energy in cars could better be spent elsewhere, like learning lines or planning tweets. I would never admit this to Mom. I've only told her I'm devastated about being away from her. But I'm excited, too. I feel guilty about that excitement, considering the fragility of her health, but the feeling is undeniable. I get to be on my own. I get space to myself, life to myself. Grandpa carries Mom into the apartment while I carry the first few boxes.
I got you a present, Ned,
Mom says as Grandpa sets her down on the couch. Since Nickelodeon's paying, Mom insisted on the pre-furnished place. She pulls a wrapped gift from under her arm.
You didn't have to do that. I even curled the ribbon, she says as she hands the DVD-sized present to me.
She's gotten more desperate these past few months. She's gotten more desperate and I've gotten more angry. I don't know if my anger is a direct result of her desperation, but it's at least a partial result of it. I can't fucking handle how desperate she is. The sicker she gets, the cuter she becomes in her intonation. The more innocent she becomes, the more she pleads with me. It's like she's begging me to not slip away, and I want to scream, "You're the one slipping away." I could swear she can tell that I want to scream because she doubles down on the cuteness, which makes me want to double down on the scream. But I don't. I keep it in. And then she looks at me with her big eyes, and I know she doesn't. She couldn't. But I almost feel like she's enjoying this. I almost feel like she's enjoying the pain. Like it's a representation to her of how much I care.
Aren't you going to open it?
Mom asks.
Oh, right.
I unwrap the present. It's a DVD of The Sting. Mom loves Robert Redford. I do too, but she loves him more.
I figured we could watch it tonight after you unpack.
Oh, okay. That'll be great.
Yeah.
Mom says, removing her hat to scratch her bald head.
And then, I was thinking, I don't have chemo tomorrow, so I could spend the night, you know, if you want.
She looks at me doe-eyed, wringing her hands nervously. I immediately know what this is. This is not Mom spending the night. This is Mom spending every night for the foreseeable future. This is Mom moving in. I don't want her to spend the night. Sure, you can spend the night, I say. And I continue to say it every single night for the next 3 months until eventually she doesn't even ask it anymore. She just expects it. This is not my first ever solo apartment. This is our apartment. We are roommates. '43. I'm sitting on the log ride at Six Flags, stuffed into the front seat of the log with 5 iCarly crew members tucked into the seats behind me. My coworker Joe, the one seated directly behind me, keeps touching me. At first I couldn't tell if it was an accident since I know he's in his 30s and has a girlfriend. But now it's happened so many times that I'm sure it's on purpose. I say nothing because the truth is it feels nice. The truth is I want him to touch me like this. Our friendship has been flirty for the past few months, ever since we were the first two in the room before a table read. Joe and I got to talking and he mentioned his favorite movie, Dazed and Confused, which I went home and watched that night so that we'd have something to talk about the next day. I wanted so badly to impress him since he was older and wiser than me. We swapped words with friends' usernames and Joe started offering me rides home from work, where he'd play Daft Punk albums front to back and explain to me what made their music so genius. I didn't really like the electronic sound, but I loved that Joe wanted to teach me why I should. Now he's touching me. The way he's touching me. This is another level. Or so I assume. I've never been touched like this before, so I don't know exactly. Sure, there was the kiss with Lucas at the Hampton Inn, but since then, romance has been non-existent in my life. All I know is that this feels like more than just a friendly touch. My whole body tingles when his hand lands on my back. The sensation is exhilarating and overwhelming and scary. In this moment, I know that one way or another, we're going to be together.
44.
Miranda and I were going to have a sleepover. I lie as I fix Mom and me a plate of steamed vegetables for dinner. I already ate dinner earlier on set and felt awful about it. I'm too ashamed to tell Mom.
What am I going to do alone without you? Mom asks genuinely, fighting back tears. I'll miss you more than anything. I just love you so much, Ned.
I'll miss you too, Mommy. This is just something Miranda and I have been planning for a while. I lie twice with this one. The first lie is that I'll miss her. I won't miss her. I will be happy to have space from her. She's been sleeping in my bed every night since we moved into my not-solo apartment, and it's hard to sleep because she clings to me all night long. The second lie is that Miranda and I are having a sleepover. We have sleepovers every couple of weeks, but not tonight. Tonight, Joe is going to stay with me. But Mom can't know about Joe because Mom would never approve. Mom only approves of me hanging out with two types of boys, Mormons and gays. And even then, she wants to supervise the hangout, just because a boy reads 3rd Nephi. I set the plate of steamed vegetables in front of Mom. She pokes at a cube of squash before forking it into her mouth.
Yeah, but I need you right now, Net,
Mom says, looking down. I'll be back tomorrow, I say gently, hoping this will comfort her enough for us to be able to move on from the topic. There's a long pause where I wait for Mom to say something. She looks off and her eyes glaze with an intensity that seems dissociative. It scares me. Just as I'm about to ask her what's going on, she snaps her head toward me, picks the TV remote up off the coffee table, and chucks it at my head. I duck aside to avoid it.
You're lying to me, you liar, Mom says, spitting as her face contorts. I'm gonna find out what's going on. Mark my words, you filthy little lying whore.
Mom's been harsh with me before, but she's never spoken to me like this.
You better bet your ass I'll be able to sniff the lies on you tomorrow when you come back, she says dramatically.
It's obvious to me how much Mom wanted to be an actress. Right, Mark? Mom whips her head around to my dad, who has been here the whole time not saying a word, as usual. He nods quickly, scared of her wrath. Fed up, I grab my backpack and start to head out.
I'm gonna figure out what you're up to, you liar!
Mom screams. My nervous system jolts, but I pretend to ignore her. I head out the front door, letting it slam shut behind me. Joe picks me up on the corner of Sunset and Vine. The passenger door on his Ford Taurus is slammed in and jammed shut from a years-old accident, so I crawl over him in the driver's seat to sit down in the passenger seat. I'm still shaking from the interaction with Mom. I look at Joe. His eyes are glassy. There's a sweet, rotten smell radiating off him. I'm disappointed. Tonight was supposed to be our first night together as an official couple. I wanted it to be romantic and magical and momentous. Instead, Joe's sad and drunk, and I'm trying hard to resist the disillusionment.
Did you do it? I ask anxiously.
Yes, I broke up with her. I wouldn't be here if I didn't, he says, his words slurring.
Right. How are you?
He snort laughs.
How do you think I am?
Joe looks down like he feels bad for snapping. This side of him comes out when he's drunk. He starts driving to the Sheraton Universal where I booked us a room. I'm concerned that he's driving while drunk, but I fear bringing this up because I know it'll make him more erratic. By the time Joe gets us there and we get to our room, it's past midnight. Joe tries to get the key into the key slot, but he's too wobbly, so I take the key and shove it in.
I could have done it, he says.
Joe stumbles in after me and immediately collapses onto the bed. At first, I think he must be really tired, until he rolls over onto his back and I can see that there are tears streaming down his cheeks. His chest heaves. He makes that gross hiccupy cry sound.
What's the matter? What's the matter?
What have I done? What have I done?
He sobs.
We were together for 5 years. 5 years! We just moved in together. We were gonna get married.
I lie down next to him and hug him. I'm the big spoon. He rattles on about his regret and remorse. If I were good enough, he wouldn't be feeling this way. He wouldn't be sad.
I thought you wanted this, I say, looking for reassurance.
You won't even have sex with me.
He wails. It's true. I won't have sex with him. Even though my family stopped going to church, there are still a few rules of the religion that, for whatever reason, I can't bring myself to break. One of them being no sex before marriage. We've been seeing each other for the past 3 months. We keep things secretive at work, which really causes the tension to build up. Then after work most nights, we get together for a few hours, at his place if his girlfriend's not around, at his friend's place if she is. We've made out and rubbed on each other, but we've never had sex and I've never even touched his penis.
I'm sorry, I'm just not ready, I tell him with a finality that makes me proud.
Well, can you give me a blowjob at least?
Joe lifts his head off the bed like a hopeful, needy puppy.
I don't want to do that.
Joe throws his head back onto the pillow and the tears are replaced with a sharp anger.
This is ridiculous. My needs aren't being met.
We can make out, I offer.
I don't want to make out. I'm 32 years old.
I feel stupid for suggesting the idea and embarrassed for not being sexually advanced enough to meet Joe's needs. Even though I'm 18, I feel like a child.
You're too young for me. This is never going to work.
Joe starts to get up off the bed.
Okay, I'll do it.
I say, immediately disappointed in myself. Joe lies back down and sprawls out lazily like he's already over the idea but might as well go forward with it since we're both here. He unzips his pants and pulls out his penis. I look at it for a long time. What am I supposed to do? I've never done this before. Yeah, it's not a turn-on when you say shit like that. I've seen a certain shortness to Joe at times, but this feels different. I could justify his behavior as him being drunker than normal. Since I've never had alcohol myself, other than that splash of the creator-spiked coffee, this is hard for me to gauge, so I usually just guess how much he's had by how crooked he's walking or how slurred his words are. I could also justify his behavior as him being overwhelmed with grief from his breakup, but honestly, I don't even need to justify it as anything because I'm so desperate to be with him. He's so much older than me and cooler than me, and I've never felt this way about anyone before, so I know he must have something special. I dive forward, and then I start doing it. Licking it and sucking it and hoping that's what I'm supposed to be doing and hoping I'm doing it in a way that's pleasurable to him. But I have no idea. I've been an actor for a dozen years. I'm nothing without direction. I'm about to finish, Joe says with a gasp. Sounds like it's a good thing. I don't know what's about to happen. Speed it up a little. Thank you, I say. Direction. And then suddenly, something that tastes like warm liquid plastic shoots into my mouth. I spit it out onto the bedspread. Something came out! Oh my god, something just came out! Yeah, it's cum. Joe looks at me with dull annoyance. What's cum? Joe turns on his side, facing away from me, and clutches a pillow tight to his chest. He takes a long breath. What have I done? He asks. Aloha. The pretty Four Seasons Resort Maui employee greets us as she drapes a floral lei around my neck and a nut lei around Joe's. Joe's eyes linger on the employee for 0.2 seconds too long. I hate the bitch. I make a mental note to work on jealousy someday whenever I get around to it. We check into the hotel, reiterating multiple times that the reservation is under my name and not Joe's. Whether it's the age difference between Joe and me or just sexism, nobody seems to believe that a trip to the Four Seasons might be my doing and not his. Granted, it's not exactly my doing. It's Nickelodeon's doing. This was each cast member's fifth season wrap gift, 4 nights and 5 days at the Four Seasons Resort Maui at Wailea for the cast member and one guest. Of course, Joe's my guest. We've been together for a year at this point, and our relationship has settled into a nice groove. Sure, 50% of the time, things are chaotic and tumultuous. Joe's drunk and I'm hysterical. Joe's upset that I'm too possessive, and I'm upset that Joe's gotten back into debt 3 weeks after I paid it off for him. But the other 50% of the time, things are great. We watch reruns of Survivor. We have stupid but fun inside jokes. We laugh a lot. We still haven't had sex, but I've gotten better at giving blowjobs. This relationship looks and feels to me like a huge step up from my parents' relationship. They had the screaming, tumultuous fighting part, but none of the fun. The only problem is that Mom still doesn't know about our relationship. Mom had to move out of my apartment a few months back to be closer to her oncologist in Orange County now that her appointments are near daily. Now that we're not physically in the same space together, Mom calls me 10 or so times a day to keep up to date on my life. How big of a role my character has in any given episode of the show, if I've been auditioning for anything else lately, pitches for why I should get back into country music. I quit my recording contract after Mom's cancer took a turn for the worse. I'm worried about how I'm going to get through a 4-night and 5-day stay at the Four Seasons without Mom knowing who I'm with. We decide I'll tell Mom I'm with Colton, my gay friend she approves of because there's no way his penis is entering me, who will then join in 3-way calls to help me out so Mom won't know I'm lying. Lying to Mom is difficult for me. Whenever I lie to her to protect my relationship with Joe, I hang up the phone and weep into Joe's arms from the guilt I feel. I tell him I wish I could be honest with her, I wish she could meet him, I wish I wasn't scared of her. And Joe runs his hands through my hair and comforts me. I feel the wedge between Mom and I growing by the day. With every lie I tell, I feel myself slipping further away from her. With every pound I gain, every binge I partake in, I feel myself getting more disconnected from her. I'm so confused and troubled by this wedge. I'm desperate to feel close with her, but also desperate for that closeness to be on my terms, not hers. I want her to know me for who I'm becoming. I want her to allow my growth. I want her to want me to be me. But that feels more like a fantasy than a possibility. For now, at least. So for now, I lie. We're 3 days into the vacation, and the plan is going smoothly. Each day, Colton and I 3-way call Mom to tell her about our snorkeling adventures and off-roading jeep drives and white sand beach walks. She laughs along as Colton gives follow-up details that scream I'm definitely not walking through a Burbank Target right now. But in the late afternoon on day 3, Joe and I are paddleboarding on the beach in front of the hotel when he spots it and tells me to duck. I look to see what he's talking about, and there in the distance, near one of the banana yellow cabanas, I see a squat little paparazzo snapping photos of me and Joe. Shit. Shit, shit, shit. This is a disaster. We swim to the sand, dump the paddleboards, wrap some fancy towels around ourselves, and hurry into the hotel's back entrance. The paparazzo snaps photos of us the whole time. By the time we're in our room, I'm panicking, rattling off the list of ways Mom might punish me, disown me, or threaten me. Joe unsuccessfully tries to keep me calm. Eventually, I've been hysterical enough for long enough that I'm completely emotionally depleted. I fall asleep on the bed by 6 p.m. The sight I wake up to the next morning is not the beautiful palm trees out the window, or the shimmering turquoise water, or a young, happy newlywed couple canoodling in a hammock in the distance. It's my cold, hard iPhone screen with a glaring notification that terrifies me. 37 missed calls from Mommy, 16 voicemails, and 4 missed emails. We no longer share an account. I recently created my own thanks to Joe's encouragement. I open the top email. Dear Net, I am so disappointed in you. You used to be my perfect little angel, but now you are nothing more than a little slut, a floozy, all used up. And to think, you wasted it on that hideous ogre of a man. I saw the pictures on a website called TMZ. I saw you in Hawaii with him. I saw you rubbing his disgusting hairy stomach. I knew you were lying about Colton. Add that to the list of things you are. Liar, conniving, evil. You look pudgier, too. It's clear you're eating your guilt. Thinking of you with his ding-dong inside of you makes me sick. Sick. I raised you better than this. What happened to my good little girl? Where did she go? And who is this monster that has replaced her? You're an ugly monster now. I told your brothers about you, and they all said they disown you just like I do. We want nothing to do with you. Love, Mom. Or should I say Deb, since I am no longer your mother. P.S. Send money for a new fridge. Ours broke. I hunch over and bury my head in my hands, breaking into a sob. Joe rubs my back and assures me that my mother is not okay, but I assure him it's the opposite. I'm not okay. Maybe she's right. Maybe I've lost my way. Maybe I'm an evil monster. You can't let her get to you like this, he says. I pick up my phone and urgently start typing TMZ into my search bar. Joe reminds me we agreed not to look at the pictures. He knows my body image isn't good. But I don't care. I need to see them. I need to see if Mom's right. She is. I look awful. My body and face repulse me. I do look pudgy. I no longer wear one pieces, but I still wear board shorts to hide my ass, which is curvy and womanly and disgusts me for being those things. Joe tells me my tits look great in my bikini top, but I don't see it. I think boobs are hideous. I hate them. I wish I was flat-chested and curveless. I wish nothing was sexual or suggestive about my body. My tears are replaced by my venomous self-loathing. Joe, sensing a shift in me, nabs the phone out of my hands and tells me it's going in the hotel safe. I don't object. Over the next 2 days, my phone stays in the safe and my bathing suit stays flung over the bathroom door handle where I last left it. Joe and I try to make the most of our remaining time in Hawaii by going on hikes and drives and other activities that don't involve me removing any clothes in public. By the last morning of the trip, I've been distracted enough and my phone's been far away enough that I've almost forgotten the paparazzo incident and the vicious email from Mom. But then Joe and I are packing up our bags, and out of the corner of my eye, I see him discreetly entering the code on the safe. He pulls my phone out and goes to tuck it into his pocket. I ask to see it first. He reminds me this is a bad idea and that it won't be anything but harmful for me if I look at it, but I can't not. I want to see it. I need to see it. As soon as the phone's in my hands, I know I've made a mistake, but it's too late now. 45 missed calls from Mom, 22 unread emails from her. I start reading through the messages frenetically, and each one gets more aggressive than the last. She calls me a dimwit, loser, scumbag, devil child. Joe says we're running late for the airport. I don't care. I read another email. This one's titled, Letter to Your Fans. I open it up and find a scathing note attached, a note that Mom tells me she's posted to an online Jeanette McCurdy fan club in an attempt to get my fans to flee from me. She says that she's going to steal all my fans, that she deserves them more than I do, that she swears to God she's going to sign up for Vine and they're all going to love her comedy videos. I wonder if Mom's bluffing, so I checked the fan club she referenced. No bluff. There's Mom's message right on the front page of the fan club. I almost can't believe it. I go back to my email, and another new message from Mom has popped up. I open it. You caused my cancer to come back. I hope you're happy knowing this. You have to live with this fact. You gave me cancer. I draft a response to her, asking if we can just sit down and talk this out face to face. I'm sure that if she'll just grant me that, I can explain myself enough to earn her approval. I'm desperate, pleading. My dear Nani Mommy, please can we at least just meet up in person to talk about this? Please. Just me and you. We can sit down and talk this out. I can answer any questions you have. Please, Mommy. I hate letting you down. I would do anything to not disappoint you. I feel confident that if you knew the whole situation, you wouldn't think these things about me. I love you so much. I want to be close to you again. I miss you. Love, Nettie. I click my phone off and tuck it into Joe's pocket. He asks what she said. I tell him nothing. I'm numb. Catatonic. The entire plane ride home, I don't say a word. Over the past few years, Mom and I have grown apart in a way that I never thought was possible. Between fame and Joe, the strain between me and Mom has gotten nearly intolerable. Plus, there's a strain of her cancer. Maybe all of this is actually just about the strain of her cancer. Why can't she admit that she's dying? Why can't I admit that she's dying? I hate her for caring so much about fame, and she hates me for caring so much about Joe. There seems to be more hate than love for each other right now, but maybe we're both just scared. Maybe we're just letting this wedge between us grow, because deep down we both know that soon enough this wedge will be out of our control. The plane lands. While we're circling the tarmac, I open my email draft to Mom. I hit send. Moments later, my phone pings with a response from Mom. Sure, we can meet up. P.S. Reminder to send fridge money. Our yogurt has soured.
Jeanette, will you sing Wind Beneath My Wings at my funeral?
Mom and I are sitting at the Panda Express on Coenga Boulevard for Mom's birthday dinner. Mom's chewing steamed broccoli and I'm chewing steamed cabbage, and we're both going through the motions of our relationship because that's what we do nowadays. This started the first time we got together after the Hawaii trip. Dad drove her to my place and lifted her up out of her wheelchair and set her down on the couch. While we waited for our tea to steep, I waited for her to bring up the Joe situation, since I thought that's why we were meeting up in the first place, to talk about it. But she never brought it up. She just asked me trivial questions about work, and I asked her trivial questions about the last episode of NCIS. Mom's big into Mark Harmon. When's she gonna bring it up? I wondered. And I kept wondering until, before I knew it, our 2 hours together were over and Dad came back to pick her up and take her home. By the time we're here at the Panda Express on Coenga Boulevard, this way of communicating, polite small talk with an undercurrent of pain and resentment, has been our new reality for several months, enough time that it's not new anymore. That's why it shocks me that Mom has asked me to sing Wind Beneath My Wings at her funeral. Mom's cancer falls under the category of things that we pretend don't exist because they're uncomfortable to talk about. Mom asking this question is a breach of our unspoken rule. I don't know how to process this or how to proceed.
You've got to do it with emotion, though. You've got to believe your words. It won't work if you're only given 50%.
I haven't even agreed to sing it yet, and Mom's already giving me performance notes.
Let me hear you try it. Mom, we're in Panda Express. I'm not gonna... Just try it.
It must have been cold there in my shadow. Involuntarily, my singing voice starts pouring out of my mouth. My body is programmed to Mom on demand. A nearby employee watches me out of the corner of her eye as she mops. To never have...
More emotion, more sadness. Feel it, Angel.
To never have sunlight on your face. A little heavy on the vibrato, but Mom's into that sort of thing.
Good, stop. I don't want to burn you out. Your performance peaks early. So are you going to do it?
I feel obligated. It's Mom's dying wish. The only problem is, I don't think I have the range to sing it. I'm okay in the verses where I can use my lower register, but once the song hits that soaring chorus, it's way out of my range. Back at my place, Mom asks me to pull the song up on YouTube so I can practice along and give her a taste of what the final performance will be. I thought you didn't want to burn me out.
Well, we're practicing so far ahead, hopefully, that it won't matter.
Mom's pointed choice of words, or word, rather, hits me hard. Hopefully. I feel furious with her, then immediately guilty for feeling furious. I must be a terrible person to be able to feel fury at my mother while she's slowly dying. I throw the energy of my guilt into meeting Mom's wish. Maybe that'll clear my conscience. I pull up the song on YouTube and another tab with the lyrics, and then I begin. The verse is, as expected, fine. But once I get to the "did you ever" part, it's confirmed. Out of my range.
Well, it's because you didn't do any vocal warm-ups, Mom assures me. Do some vocal warm-ups and try again.
I do 10 minutes of me-may moves before trying again, but then I try again and it's the same issue. I try one more time just to make sure. It's out of my range, I finally admit.
Don't say that,
Mom says sharply. I'm sorry.
You'll get there. I know you'll get there. You got plenty of time to practice. Hopefully.
I don't want to practice the song my dying mother has instructed me to sing at her funeral. I don't want to think about my mother's funeral. I want to go back to ignoring the things that make us uncomfortable to talk about. As much as I thought I hated it, I want to go back to pretending.
Why don't you just try it a couple more times tonight, sweetheart?
Mom urges as she removes her Ugg hat to scratch her bald head. On the surface, it seems like such a sad gesture, but I could swear she's doing this manipulatively. I click back to the beginning of the song. The twinkly 1980s intro starts. I try again.
You're going the wrong way, I tell Grandpa over speakerphone as I watch him from my window.
Whoops.
He pulls a 180 with Mom's wheelchair and starts heading in the opposite direction. I'm looking down at them from the courtyard-facing window of my apartment. I chose this apartment for its view, or rather, for what's not its view. The most desired units in the complex are the ones facing Sunset Boulevard, looking right out onto the bustling city. But there was no way I would have gone for one of those, because those complexes face Nickelodeon Studios.
and plastered on the side of Nickelodeon Studios is a bright purple and yellow billboard for iCarly, complete with my fake smile and cheesy airbrushed hairdo. There was no way I was waking up every morning to face myself. After a few wrong turns and elevator button pushes, Grandpa and Mom finally make it up to my unit. We chit-chat for a few minutes over tea before heading back down to the parking structure so Grandpa can drive us to lunch. "Where do you want to go?" I ask. "Please don't say it. Please don't say it. Please don't."
"Wendy's?" Mom suggests innocently.
"Sure," I say through a tight smile. There's nothing inherently wrong with Wendy's. In fact, I'd go so far as to say there are several things inherently right with it. We've all tried the Frosty. My tenseness isn't coming from Wendy's. It's coming from Mom's reasoning for suggesting Wendy's. She knows I have money and could take her anywhere she'd like, and yet she chooses Wendy's not because she likes it, but because she can go and tell her friends or fellow churchgoers how humble she is, how down to earth, that even on a day as special as her birthday, all she did was eat a side salad from a fast food restaurant. This thing in Mom drives me nuts, this thing where she yearns to be pitied. She's got stage 4 cancer, she's already plenty pitied, she doesn't need to throw Wendy's on top of it. Grandpa pulls out of the structure and gets to the first stoplight, the stoplight that sits directly in front of the giant, terrifying iCarly poster. I start organizing his messy back seat pockets out of anxiety. I pull out papers, crumpled up receipts, dirty napkins, and a copy of Sean Hannity's Conservative Victory. Grandpa looks over his shoulder to see what I'm doing. "You want to borrow that? I'm done with it. Excellent read. Very excellent read." He raps on his dashboard as punctuation. "Maybe." "No."
"There she is," Mom says as she snaps a photo of the giant poster with her disposable Kodak camera.
She has at least 100 photos of that same billboard. As she takes the picture, the camera drops out of her hand and to the floor. I stretch down to pick it up, and by the time I sit upright with it, Mom's convulsing. Her hands are clenched into tight little balls and her face is contorted so that one eye is squinted shut and her mouth is scrunched up entirely to one side. Her convulsing looks like the rocking of somebody in a mental hospital. I'm horrified. I tell Grandpa something's wrong. He takes the Lord's name in vain. Mom says nothing because she can't. Grandpa looks both ways to make sure the coast is clear, then cuts across the street, going through the red light and into the Nickelodeon Studios parking lot. Carl, the friendly security guard, recognizes him since Grandpa visits me on set often. Grandpa tells Carl to call 911. By this point, Mom is frothing at the mouth. I'm sure she's dying. Grandpa tells me to get her to lie down. I unbuckle her seatbelt and pull her onto my lap. This is the most terrifying moment of my life. The ambulance arrives impressively fast. They yank Mom onto a stretcher and buckle her in. She's still convulsing. They wheel her into the ambulance. One of the EMTs recognizes me, so he lets me ride with Mom. It's one of the rare times I'm grateful to be recognized. I grip Mom's hand and squeeze it. I tell her everything's going to be okay, even though I'm sure it's not. The siren starts blaring from the ambulance. It sounds warped when you hear it from inside the vehicle that's making it. The driver pulls a right out of the parking lot. As I'm squeezing my dying mother's hand and watching froth spill out of her mouth, we pass the poster again. I see my dead-eyed grin and my stupid fucking outdated hairstyle. My life is mocking me. It's the day before Christmas Eve. Mom's been in the ICU for a week, unresponsive. She had a seizure as a result of her brain tumor, which is apparently a pretty regular occurrence, the doctor tells us, as if the regularity makes it any less horrific. Marcus, Dustin, Scotty, and I sit in a row in the waiting room while Grandma and Grandpa visit with her in the ICU. We're all quiet. Finally, I offer to go pick up some Burger King for all of us because I'm desperate for a distraction, and food is the perfect distraction. None of the boys want anything. They can't eat right now, they tell me. I envy them. I envy that their sadness and stress translate to a lack of hunger. I go to the Burger King across the street. I order a Whopper and fries and a Coke Icy, and some tacos and chicken sticks to go with it. The ordering and the eating happen in rapid succession and both feel out of my control. Afterward, my stomach feels distended. I consider making myself throw up. I've heard about this before, but never actually tried it. Now seems like as good a moment as ever to try. I shove my Burger King bag into an overstuffed trash can and head back to the hospital. I rush through the entrance doors, cut through the lobby, and hop on the elevator, excited about my new plan. I get off the elevator at the ICU. My brothers are no longer in the waiting room. They must be visiting Mom. I head to the two-stall bathroom and make sure no one else is in there. Then I kneel on the cold, hard, tiled hospital floor and shove my fingers down my throat. Ow. I poke the back of my throat. It hurts, but nothing comes out. I try again. Nothing. One more time. Still nothing. Fuck this. I give up. I wash my hands. I'm a failure at not eating, and I'm a failure at getting rid of the food I do eat. I hurry down the hallway and push open the heavy door that leads to Mom's ICU room. Marcus, Dustin, and Scotty are standing around her. You can barely make out the shape of her little body underneath the hospital sheets and blankets. She's awake, Dustin tells me. I rush over to her bedside and take her hand in mine. I love the way her hands feel. They're small and her fingers are short. Her skin is shiny and warm.
"Nan,"
she says as she turns her head feebly to look at me. My eyes well with tears. Maybe she's going to be okay after all. I can't believe it. I'm elated.
"The boys said you stopped at Burger King. You don't need to be eating that stuff. A lot of grams of fat in a Whopper."
I beam. A tear trickles down my cheek. Mom's gonna live. For now, she's gonna live.
"I know, Mama. I know. I did get it without mayo." She sighs. "Still."
"49. Miranda's crying. I'm crying. We're both crying. We can't stop crying. For me, it's not that iCarly's ending. It's not that today is our last day ever taping iCarly. That I'm fine with, even excited about. Definitely ready for. Even though I'm wary of starting my spinoff, I'm glad to at least be saying goodbye to this project that makes me feel like I'm living every day in the Groundhog Day movie, doing the same thing over and over again. The reason I'm crying is that I don't know what will become of my friendship with Miranda. We've gotten so close, like sisters but without the passive aggression and weird tensions. I have my judgments around female friendships being catty and petty and backstabby, but that couldn't be further from the truth with Miranda. With Miranda, it's always been so easy. Our friendship is pure. An AD hands me and Miranda a tissue. We blow our noses hideously and get back on our marks to do one last take of the final scene we're shooting together. The sadness takes both of us over. We hold each other and cry. This feeling of sadness and ending is really common on sets. You get to know the people around you so intimately because you're around them more than you're around your family. For a period of time. And then you aren't anymore. And little by little, you realize you start talking less and less to the people you thought you were so intimate with. Until you don't talk to them at all anymore. And it makes you wonder if you were ever really intimate with them in the first place, or if it was all just a facade, if the connections were as temporary as the sets they were made on. I don't like knowing people in the context of things. Oh, that's the person I work out with. That's the person I'm in a book club with. That's the person I did that show with. Because once the context ends, so does the friendship. I yearn to know the people I love deeply and intimately, without context, without boxes, and I yearn for them to know me that way too. And as much as I think I know Miranda deeply and intimately, I don't like that I know her through the context of iCarly, because iCarly is ending, and I don't want our friendship to end with it. 50.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Now's not the time to throw us away. Now's when you need us most.
I don't think so. I think if I go through these next few months with you, I'll get too attached.
Why don't you want to be attached? Isn't being attached to someone a good thing? Isn't that what love is?
I'm just worried about being attached while my mom's, you know... I can't say it out loud. The realer it becomes, the more I can't say it out loud. Doctors have been saying that Mom's health is rapidly declining for a while, long enough for me to question their use of the word rapidly. Regardless, it's declining. She's wheelchair-bound. She's weaker than I've ever seen her. The cancer has spread to just about everywhere. The end is near. I bite my nail. Like, since I'm more attached to her than anyone, I worry all the attachment toward her will just pile onto whoever I'm with, I say.
Well, that's fine with me. I want the pile. Pile it on.
Not the response I was hoping for. I backpedal.
Maybe I misspoke. I just think it's a distraction from what I need to be focusing on.
Family. I'm a distraction? No, yes, I don't know. I scratch my head. I want out of this moment in Tony's darts away, Joe's favorite vegan joint in Burbank.
Look, if you don't love me anymore, you can just say it. I can take it, he says, his voice cracking on the last part, betraying his words.
Just then, his vegan sausage and beer come. The timing of food at restaurants is always impeccably in line with the phrase you'd least like someone to overhear. You almost have to appreciate it. It's like the waiter's work on this.
I do love you. Then why are you breaking up with me?
Joe takes a big bite of his sausage, an obnoxiously big bite. He's got vegan mayonnaise smeared all over his lip. It's disgusting. Maybe this is why. Maybe it's not about the mom stuff at all. Maybe I'm just over it. His chewing bothers me most of the time. The baby voice he overuses makes me cringe. His jokes aren't funny. He lacks ambition. He drinks too much. He has anger issues. Our age gap no longer feels cool to me and instead feels a little embarrassing for both of us. I wonder what laundry list of flaws he's racked up about me at this point. What could he say? I'm selfish. I'm possessive. I'm not social enough. I don't like his friends. I'm too judgmental. I don't give him enough attention. Joe's still chewing the same bite. He's been chewing this same bite for a goddamned minute. Why not just take smaller bites? There's an easy solve to this, Joe. Did you hear me? He asks. If you still love me, why are you breaking up with me? Something switches in me in this vegan mayonnaise-filled moment. All my patience is gone. I'm in a vegan dive bar, smelling beer I don't care to drink, with basketball and football games I don't care to watch blaring from the excessive amount of TVs around me. I'm sitting on a bar stool with uneven legs opposite a man I no longer love. I am numb. I am done. Look, I just am. Miranda's driving and I'm sitting shotgun in her Porsche Cayenne, where we spend 50% of our time together these days. And we spend a lot of time together these days. There was no need to worry about context. Our friendship has gotten stronger since iCarly ended. We hang out 3 or 4 times a week. Usually one of the nights is a sleepover, like last night. Typically the sleepover is at Miranda's place, but last night we stayed at the St. Regis Laguna Beach because our series wrap gift was a night there. The sleepover might as well have been at Miranda's place because we didn't do anything that made our sleepover any more St. Regis-y than our other ones. We sat in the room and watched some movie about the porn industry starring Amanda Seyfried and decided that, even though the movie was mediocre and we don't know how to pronounce her last name, Amanda Seyfried is a walking angel of beauty. We talked about how sad and miserable we are and how we feel guilty about it because we have so much to be grateful for. We watched Dance Moms until we fell asleep. Between Abby Lee Miller's abusive tactics and the intensity of the parents, we relate deeply. We left the hotel not long ago. Miranda makes her way toward the nearest freeway on-ramp. We're complain laughing about something while Katy Perry's Roar plays in the background. We once saw the Rolling Stones together, but who are we kidding? We're 21-year-old females and Katy Perry does much more for us than Mick Jagger. My phone rings. Mommy. Hello? Ned, help me! Whoa, whoa, slow down, what's the matter? Help! I'm scared! What are you scared of? They're taking me back for my surgery! Mom's been set to have this surgery for a while. The breast implant from her mastectomy recently started leaking, so the doctor needs to go in there, clean up the leakage, and repair the implant. Supposedly a fairly easy procedure. It's gonna be fine, it's just a minor surgery. Something's not right, Ned, something's not right! I hear a nurse in the background. Ma'am, no phones are allowed here.
Please, Ned, do something! What do you want me to do? I don't know, I need you!
She sounds panic-stricken. There's a trembling to her voice that I've never heard before. It terrifies me. Dad takes the phone. Hey, Jeanette?
Yeah?
She's just emotional right now. She's on the hospital bed. They're rolling her to the room for her surgery now. I'm with her. Everything's fine. Should I come? Mom shouts,
yes!
Dad says, no. I ask again, should I come? No, it's fine, Dad says. They'd be done by the time you got here. It's gonna be quick, totally harmless. The doctors are great. I'll call you afterward. Cool. I turn up Roar. Miranda keeps driving.
Everything okay?
Yeah, it's nothing. She doesn't press. We drive in silence for a few minutes, and then we start talking again about whatever. Something's off. I can feel it in my gut. We stop for gas, then keep driving. My phone rings again. Dad.
How'd it go?
Hey, Mom's not okay.
What?
Apparently her body couldn't withstand the surgery.
Wait, what? I thought it was going to be harmless.
She's in a coma. But you said the doctors were great. She's not doing well. You need to get to the hospital right away. I hang up the phone, numb. I tell Miranda what's happened. She offers to drive me to the hospital. I say okay. I stare out the window. Miranda stops at a red light. It's Seyfried, Miranda says plainly. I looked it up. 52.
Mommy, did you hear me? I said I'm so skinny right now. I'm finally down to 89 pounds.
I uncross my legs. I lean forward, desperate.
89!
I'm grateful that since Mom's been in a coma, I've stopped binging. In fact, I've eaten almost nothing. I've been losing weight rapidly. Beep,